back to the American Revolution podcast, episode 62, Valcour Island. So before I start this episode, a lot of people sent messages out on the Facebook page and through other outlets just wondering what was going on. It has been probably a solid almost 2 months since my last post. And I want to first thank everyone for just checking, asking, saying, hey, what's going on? You kind of stopped in the middle of our story and we're wanting more. One, that gives me a little bit of an ego boost, so I do appreciate that. So a bit of an explanation is warranted by you guys. First, one, I got a new puppy, as you can hear him barking in the background. He is a beagle, so you might hear him howl every once in a while. I'll try my best to try and control that. We got a new puppy. We got him from the SPCA, which is a fantastic organization, except when we got him, he was a little sick. So I spent a week or so trying to nurse him back to health. Then, at the same time, I was being moved from my elementary school that I was working into the high school, bigger class, bigger caseload. I now work in a classroom that is strictly 100% kids with severe special needs, severe and moderate special needs. So that was a full-time gig in and of itself. And on a more personal note, unfortunately, my uncle, who was I was very close with, lost his fight with cancer. So this episode is actually going to be dedicated to Tim Kelvis, my uncle, a man who spent his life on the water. So it's just by happenstance that this episode that we're going to talk about is the Battle of Valcour Island. So let's dive right into this. Where did we leave off? Well, we have two armies staring at each other. More figuratively than literally. They weren't actually looking across the lake at each other. Lake Champlain is a rather long lake. But they're at opposite ends of the lake, and they know that to gain supremacy in the north, they're going to have to fight each other on the water. So Benedict Arnold is in charge of the American Navy. He's going to head north to find a good position to meet the British ships, and hopefully his superior numbers can outdo the British superiority on the water. Now, the British don't have as many large-scale ships as the Americans do. In a sense, they only have four. They have the Loyal Convert, they have the Maria, the Clinton, and they have the large gondola, the Thunderer. I really hate the whoever named that ship, but it's more like a floating barge with cannons on it. So it's not going to be something that's really going to be useful in this fight, as I have talked about in previous episodes. But here we go. As the summer gave way to autumn, the weather began to get colder. Though the men on the schooners and sloops were probably comfortable, the men on the gondolas were in the open. The gondolas were essentially open boats with an awning, possibly some lee cloth for protection from the elements. It's no surprise that the men were coming down with the cold and flu symptoms. You have 45 men on a boat that's only 50 feet long. These cramped conditions is just it's welcoming sickness to spread. But by the end of September, the men were at their breaking point. And the British haven't arrived yet. So as the days continued on, Arnold just went on hoping that the British would maybe just not come. They're going to just get themselves into winter quarters, and they would pick this fight up next year. It would be almost 2 weeks before they got word that the British were on their way. By then, it's October 8th, and there was no denying it. They were coming. But lucky for the Americans, they actually get a few days. See, on October 8th, the wind was coming from the south, so the British ships couldn't come very far down the lake. But the wind would change, as the wind always changes, and on the morning of October 11th, a nice northerly wind was coming down from the north and bringing the British with it. It was a very nice full day, and there were clear skies. Now, the Americans in Valcour Bay, they were, in all intents and purposes, just a channel between Valcour Island and the western shore of the lake. At the south end of the island was a shallow harbor, so Arnold is going to anchor the fleet there and stretch it across the water. It was a good position, about a mile and a quarter wide, and the average depth was about 18 to 60 feet at any given point. So Arnold could take advantage of the wind, and it would force the British to fight in a tight space. And if the British did have some larger ships, they would be at the disadvantage to the smaller gondolas that the Americans had available to them. Now, we've got to remember, we've talked in depth about the American ships and the British ships. Arnold has no idea that the British are bringing all these gunboats, smaller boats that can outmaneuver his boats, and they have bigger guns. So we, you know, you have to realize that when we look at battles, the people who are fighting the battles don't know what the other person has. It's not like high school football where the coaches trade tape so that each team could prepare itself for the next week's, you know, football game. So the British don't trade like, oh, we have this many ships with this many guns and this many guys and this is our poundage. No, they don't do that. So Arnold is at the everyone's at the disadvantage. Oh, well, we have this, you know, many ships. Let's hope that we're better than the other side. The other key thing to remember about the channel between Valcour Island and the western shore of Lake Champlain is that Arnold has an escape route. He didn't just back himself into a corner. He has an escape route. The other reason he placed his fleet there is because he had defilade from the British ships. See, Valcour Island isn't a tall island, so it's not like you couldn't see over it. But the thing was, it was very densely wooded, so you can't see through it. So if there was no trees, they would be able to see each other and they would be able to plan accordingly, yada, yada, yada. But the woods block it, so Arnold has the advantage. The British can't see through the woods. So he's going to put himself in a nice tight position that he can fight from. The other thing that he does is he puts a guard ship out on the water just far enough to see the British coming and hopefully beat a quick retreat so that they can get back into position. The hope is that he can ambush the British before they see him. At least that's the hope. On the British side of things, we're going to rewind. On October 9th, the British fleet was moving from Isle Anou to Point au Fer, where the army had actually moved itself. Now, we had talked about this in a previous episode, that they moved the army down because they're going to load them onto canoes, and the army is going to follow the fleet. Well, Commodore Thomas Pringle, the man who is going to be in charge of the British fleet as far as a battle command standpoint is, he wants the decks clear, ready for action, because they have no idea where the American fleet is. So they have no idea whenever they can possibly pop out. He also has the distinct honor, and I put that in air quotes because I'm being sarcastic, of having Sir Guy Carleton aboard his boat. This doesn't make much sense from at least a command point perspective of things, because Carleton is an army officer, not a navy officer. So what the heck is he doing in a navy operation? Well, what he's doing is he's doing this as pure pride. He wants to be a part of it and say, hey, I was there and I helped and I was important. As many a British officer we will talk about in future episodes will be, I was there, I was important. Well, sorry guys, most of you are not important even though you were there. So Pringle has to deal with having Carleton on the boat. It is decided, though, that they're not going to bring the army. The army marched all this way. They're not going to bring them. The reason being is because they were in a tight position. You see, they're about to load all these troops onto canoes, and they're going to take them with them. But the problem is they don't know where the American fleet is. So what are they going to do when the American fleet pops up from somewhere? all they have to do is get through the couple of large ships and gunboats, and they can pretty much lay waste to the entire British army in one foul swoop. So the British army is left behind. They're not going to bring the army with them. It's a pointless cause. So General Burgoyne, who we will have the great honor of introducing in future episodes, is going to stay behind at Point au Fer with Baron von Rendazel, the commander of the German forces, would stay at St. John. Instead of the bateau following, there was a fleet of canoes filled with Indians under the command of Thomas Carleton, Sir Guy Carleton's younger brother. The Indians are crack shots. A lot of them have rifles. So it would just be good to have some, you know, some sort of land force to harass the Americans. And not to be cruel or crass or indifferent to the Native Americans, but I'm thinking from a standpoint of people of the time, having the local Indians do your fighting instead of paid British soldiers is also beneficial in the fact that you don't have to waste money on losing a British soldier. Indians are, as like I said, it's crass, I know, and I don't like saying it, but the Indians, in a sense, are expendable. And it sounds mean, and I get it. I totally understand. But I'm just speaking from a standpoint of why wouldn't you bring the British Army? Well, they're paid British soldiers that are expensive. The Indians are not as expensive, and they're kind of expendable. So that's the only reason I'm saying it. Okay, I'm not going to go on a tirade on my soapbox about if, you know, history is written by the victors or anything like that. I'm just going to leave it at that. So, the British fleet mounted a total of 89 guns on 34 vessels. The Americans had 78 guns on 15 vessels. And it's with the cannon itself that the difference is really going to lie. You know, the American ships were larger. They were far bigger than the gunboats of the British. The British only mounted several large-scale ships, but they had way more gunships. They had over 24 gunships. You know, so they you have things like the Thunderer, the Inflexible, the Maria, the Clinton, the Loyal Convert. You have those ships, but then you have all these gunboats. So the gunboats are really what's going to make the difference. And it's the guns themselves on the gunboats that really add up. If you add up the pounds of metal that would be that are going to be shot from the guns on these ships to measure the strength of the fleet, the British would fire over 1,000 pounds of metal with one grand volley. If you fired every gun at once, it would equal out over 1,000 pounds of metal. The Americans, if you fired every gun at once, 600 pounds. That's half as much. The problem was the capital ships on both sides only fired from the broadside. So, you know, you don't have – you're not using half your guns. If you so, like I said, 1,000 pounds from every usable gun. So half of the Inflexibles, half of the Marias, half of the Clinton's guns are useless. Why? Because they fire from the broadside, so half your guns are not being used. The Americans' gondolas had two broadsides and one forward gun, which means that if you tilt the gondolas, you can fire one broadside gun and the front gun. That's it. You can't fire from that third gun, so it's kind of wasted. So even – so you're – you know, the gondolas are losing out firepower because you're not using an entire gun. The British gunboats had one gun that faced the enemy, and they were facing forward. They're going to do most of the fighting for the British. The fact was that the Americans built large-scale ships to overwhelm the British, but they soon found a greater amount of small British ships would overwhelm them. So at first light, which would be about 5 a.m., the entire British fleet is going to head south. They're in search of the Americans. They had gotten word from some locals that they believed that the Americans were at Cumberland Head. Now, they would get there about 9:30 in the morning. No Americans. That what they don't know is that the American fleet was only 7 miles away. So within an hour, they would be in the middle of a fight with the Americans. In While the British are striking out at Cumberland Head and are cutting their losses and continuing south towards Fort Ticonderoga, at about 11 a.m., we would have our first contact between the two fleets. Dr. Robert Knox, aboard the schooner Carleton, would actually notice an American ship out in the middle of the water. But then there becomes the question, why the heck did Arnold send the ship so far out in the first place? Did he want to draw them into a fight? And if he was trying to draw them into a fight, if, you know, and we're saying this from hindsight being 2020, wouldn't it have been better to let them go past the island and then you can jump them from the rear? Because think about that heavy blow you could land on the British. Your ships are probably quicker. Your schooners are definitely, they have a double broadside. So if the schooners ended up in the middle of all of that, they would just wreak havoc. The gondolas could do so much damage to the Indian canoes. I mean, they would just rain destruction on the smaller vessels. Remember, in a matter of a short time, they could take out a good portion of the gunboats, the Indian canoes, and then they would only have to deal with the Carleton, the Maria, the Inflexible. Those would be the biggest tasks. Remember, the Thunderer, whatever the heck that stupid boat is, that barge was wholeheartedly unwieldy. They could not handle it. So if Arnold could have jumped him, my goodness, what would have happened to the British fleet? So no sooner did the American ships see the British coming towards them, they turned headed back to the American lines. For the British, well, they were given little instructions on what to do when they actually found the Americans. So every ship is just racing in a battle. It was like a pack of wolves was heading towards the American line. To get at the Americans, the British had to come around from the south end of the island and turn up. And they would have to face the American cannons the entire way. So we can't doubt that Arnold's position is strong, because the British are going to have to come around the island and then go north into the wind that they were just using to come south. So he's got them by the nuts, to be, crass. He's got them. He's holding them by the nose. He's about to kick him in the ass. Now, for the British, luckily, their gunboats could move against the wind pretty easily, because the gunboats could be powered by oars. Their larger ships didn't have that capability, so they were able to move up. Of course, one of the ships that was in that scout pack that had got out was the Royal Savage. Unfortunately, the Savage is a sailing vessel, not a gondola or a cutter like the other ships. So the schooner got held up in the wind. And the British pounced on it. Remember, they're having this pack of wolves mentality. So they're just firing into the Savage. Well, the Savage is just getting decimated. So the captain runs her aground in hopes that the men could get off the boat and escape. Well, for the British, this is blood in the water. They see this opportunity. They see these men trying to escape. They move up again. And they're firing shots at these escaping soldiers. Well, the Americans are coming to support the Savage, have open shots at the British gunboats. So the commander of the gunboats actually orders all of the gunboats to pull back and to reform into a line. They form into a line, and they stay at about 700 yards. Now, this is the genius move about it, because at 700 yards, they're well within their range of their larger guns, because remember, the gunboats are sporting 12 and 24-pound guns. But it keeps it out of the effective range of grapeshot, which would have just mauled the tightly packed crews on these boats. So these 12, 24, 18-pound guns are perfectly capable of taking shots at the Americans, but at the same time, they're keeping them also at a extreme range for the smaller American guns. Some of the largest guns that the Americans had, yes, they had some 12-pounders, but most of them, especially on the schooners and the sloops, were anywhere from 6 to 9 pounds. So the British guns are far out ranging the American guns. So for the moment, the fight is pretty even. Credit goes to Arnold, who positioned his fleet in such a way that it deprived the British the use of the capital ships. It's more difficult than I think people realize to sail a vessel, and is even more difficult in 18th century, especially when the wind is going against you. The schooners were not able to make it up the lake when they were in the face of the wind, especially the ships like the Inflexible and the Thunderer. They were completely out of the fight. The Loyal Convert, however, would be in the fight. Remember, this was a gondola that the Americans had taken over in Canada, and it was oar-powered. So she was able to move up, and she would support the British gunboats. And what they also did is some of the crew of the Convert actually got out, got onto the Savage, and used the guns that were still available and turned them on the Americans. So the Americans would now have to face off with their own vessel. So the Americans had no choice but to fire on the Royal Savage. The loyal Indians of the British landed on Valcour Island. They began to fire at the American ships with their muskets, but like I said, the range was too great, so they really did no damage. What they did do, however, was capture whatever was left of the stranded crew of the Royal Savage, those that didn't get away. The larger ships were still out of the fight. At one point, the Inflexible was able to crawl into the fight and fired a couple of broadsides to good effect, but then once again was pushed right back out of the action. Now, Arnold walked the gun deck of the Congress, aiming guns as they fired on the British. At the center of the line, the Congress was taking a beating. Not that the others were getting off any easier. The gondola in New York was swept continuously, that all the officers but Captain John Reed were killed. The Philadelphia was hit so many times she began to sink at the anchor. The Washington, like the Congress, was being slammed from the heavy guns of the gunboat, as did the Trumbull, who suffered over 30 direct hits. But for all that the Americans were taking, they were giving it back. Captain Pausch, our German officer aboard one of the British ships, commented that the American ships were well served. And after the battle, our ships had to be pretty well mended with boards and stoppers. So for 2 hours, the battle would rage before the larger vessels could actually get into the fight. The schooner Carlton got into it and unleashed a broadside on the Americans, which was immediately answered by the Americans, who spent the next hour firing on the schooner. The schooner lost its commander and the second in command early. A midshipman named Edward Puel, just a teenager, was going to be in charge. Realizing that the damage to the Carlton was becoming too much, ordered the ship out of the battle. With half the crew dead or wounded, this was going to be not such an easy task. Several times, Puel put himself in harm's way, trying to get the ship under sail and heading south. Now, this is one of those interesting twists of fates, because had he been killed during the Battle of Valcour Island, this would have deprived Britain of one of her top frigate commanders during the Napoleonic Wars. Just saying, for those interested in the Napoleonic Wars, Puel is a name that you're going to hear. Shank, the commander of the Inflexible, saw her struggling and sent boats to tow her to safety. So, the Convert, not doing so great. The Inflexible can't get into the fight. The Thunderer is doing whatever. The Maria, not really in the fight. And the Carlton is so beat up that she has to be towed out of the battle. So, we're back to where we were, the gunboats. The gunboats are going to be the ones to end out the battle. And as the day went on, the closer it got to evening, the closer it came to the end of the fighting. The American ships just had to hold out. The Americans and the British gunboats pounded away at each other for over 6 hours. And we're, for the most part, out of ammunition. Pringle, who spent the day out of range of the fighting, ordered the gunboats to pull out of range of the Americans. The gunboats would be resupplied as best they could so that they could continue fighting the next day. As the fighting tapered off, the Americans began to look at their losses. They had 60 men killed or wounded, but that's out of 760 men, so the numbers aren't so bad. The only ship that wasn't, and they only lost one ship totally. The Philadelphia would end up sinking from her wounds. But other than that, the ships were pretty well thrashed, but they still floated. That night, Arnold would call for a council of war. He knew that the fleet could not withstand another fight the next morning. So it was an easy decision. They would need to pull out, but where would they go? The wind would make it very difficult to head north, and once they headed north, then they would have to bypass the British fleet altogether. Arnold, ever a daring commander, decides that the fastest way to get out of Dodge is to go through the British fleet. And that's where we're going to leave off. We have spent a lot of time on the Battle of Valcour Island, and I apologize once again for having to step away for a little while, but there was a lot of stuff going on personally that just I needed to sort out. And I was really happy that just by happenstance, I had to do this episode now after my uncle has passed, because he wasn't a man that liked to talk a lot about historical stuff. He was an engineer. He was a man that liked to build things. He liked to tell fishing stories. He liked to do stuff like that. At least that's what he did with me. But he did always like to talk or listen, I should say. He never really talked much about it. He always listened to my stories about great naval conflicts or some more obscure naval conflicts through history. Because he loved being on the water, he loved everything to do with boats. So he would love listening to these stories and love talking about them. So it was just really nice that I could do this episode right now. This was definitely a long episode. I don't think I've ever gone this long in an episode. So I'm just – before – welcome you know, continue to ramble on aimlessly. I'm going to cut it short. I'm going to cut it at this point this week. I'm not going to do a book study or anything like that. We'll do that next week when we talk about how Arnold is going to get himself out of this sticky situation and what the aftermath of Valcour Island is going to be. Till then, everyone have a great week. And as always, keep that powder dry.